Perpetual Notion Machine on June 23rd, 2016. I'm your host, Bill Cushman. Right now, I'm recording from the Sapsucker Woods. That's in Ithaca, New York, so home of Cornell University. So I'm a long ways off from Madison right now, but I will be interviewing Greg Budney. He is the Collections Development Curator of the Macaulay Library at the Lab of Ornithology here at Cornell. So Greg's job is to curate the Macaulay Library, which is the largest online digitized archive of audio recordings of wildlife in the world. I'm being quiet because you might have heard some rustling there. That was some deer wandering through the woods. But I think you can also hear a lot of birds are out this morning. So I'm going to go over to the lab now and hang out with Greg for a little while and learn more about the audio archive, the Macaulay Library. I'm here with Greg Budney of the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And what's your position here, Greg?
I'm the curator for collections development here at the Macaulay Library.
Okay.
And my role is to help develop connections between people who are collecting recordings, and those recordings could be video or audio or even still images, to help build those connections, to make people aware of the resources of the Macaulay Library. So we're very excited to have an opportunity to talk to your audience.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. I think this is really cool. So we'll just dive into the questions. I guess when most people think about a library, especially people who aren't familiar with what you do here, they might think of like a physical building filled with like books, maybe some other media, but mostly think about books. So that's not what the Macaulay Library is. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the library, the information that you archive here, like who uses it, and a little bit about the history, and also how it's related to the lab of the ornithology here.
Sure, I'd be happy to. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology is the parent institution, the institution in which the Macaulay Library is based. The library itself has a rather long history. It goes back to about 1929 when a pioneer in sound sync film was looking for a way to demonstrate a new technology he had invented. A gentleman by the name of Theodore Case, whose company later became Fox Case Movie Tone News. He wanted to film and audio record a live singing wild bird as a way to demonstrate the power of this new technology, and he enlisted the help of the founder of the Lab of Ornithology, Arthur Allen, in doing so. His crew had tried for several weeks and failed, so Allen, when contacted by Theodore Case, encouraged them to come to Ithaca, and in May of 1929, they made the first recordings of wild birds at the south end of Cayuga Lake here in Tompkins County. They recorded a rose-breasted grosbeak, a song sparrow, and a house wren that particular day, and today you can go to the online resources, the Macaulay Library, and hear two of those 1929 recordings, which are pretty amazing given the technology. Yeah. The rose-breasted grosbeak and song sparrow recordings, just the audio, the film is unknown, the whereabouts of. Just the audio exists, and they're really stunning recordings, especially the rose-breasted grosbeak.
Cool.
And what made that possible, and this is a hallmark of the lab, is Allen's understanding of animal behavior. So he was with a team of very competent filmmakers, knew their technology, but they couldn't get access to a wild bird. They couldn't get close enough. But Allen knew exactly where the rose-breasted grosbeak, song sparrow, and house wren were going to perch. And back in those days, the way you recorded was you had to put the mic right next to where the animal was sitting. And Allen knew the specific branch that rose-breasted grosbeak was going to land on and the fence post that the song sparrow would sing from. And so it was his biological expertise that made it possible. And that's what the Lab of Ornithology brings to its constituency today, whether it's a bird watcher or a scientist. It's the scientific documentation and expertise of the collection.
Sure. So are most of the people who are the people who visit the library? I they can't see me, but air quotes visiting online.
The users of the library are research scientists. That's probably the largest group of users who are investigating everything from animal behavior to bioacoustic phenomenon. And by phenomenon, I simply mean acoustic communication in wildlife, which we're trying to gain a deeper understanding of. And the more that scientists investigate the strategies and sounds that animals use, the more we realize how highly evolved the communication strategies of strategies and systems of wildlife really are. They're quite complex and in many cases just elegant solutions to overcoming problems of sound propagation in the environment to, I'm a tiny little animal, how do I produce a wavelength, a disturbance in the air bigger than my own body? Right. Pretty amazing what they do.
Yeah. And so how big is the library? How many?
The library currently holds about 250,000 audio recordings. About 100, just under 160,000 of those have been digitized. So enough to keep you busy on a Saturday evening, probably through the weekend.
Yeah, no, for sure. I spent like 2 hours on it yesterday.
The last calculation I looked at was something on the order of about 275 days of 24-hour listening to get through the whole collection of audio. We also have 50,000 digitized video clips, which are from around the world and show amazing behaviors by animals. Probably one of the most stunning bodies of work is by Ed Scholes, and that includes birds of paradise. It covers the 39 species of bird of paradise, which are extraordinary animals and amazing creatures to watch go through their courtship display. But we have a whole host of other videos as well, and well over 800,000 still images have been submitted to the archive.
We should say so the majority of the files in the library are related to birds, right? But you have recordings and videos from all sorts of other species as well.
That's right. There are many, many mammal recordings, insect recordings. One of the largest collections in the world of frog and toad sounds is here at the Macaulay Library. So in addition to the research users, we, of course, have anyone who's interested in natural history can come to the library and explore its resources. If you're going to, say, Ecuador or you're going to East Africa and you would like to brush up on some of the sounds you're likely to hear there, you can go to the Macaulay Library webpage and search on Kenya or Tanzania and get a report of all the recordings that are found there, birds, mammals, and get an idea of what creatures in these remote corners of the world, for those of us based in North America anyway, what they sound like. The collections obviously of use to people in those countries as well, and that's one of the exciting things is we're, through digitization, we're really swinging the doors open on an amazing worldwide resource. Another major group are natural history filmmakers and filmmakers in general. The fellows from Skywalker Sound make regular use of the Macaulay Library resources. Very few of the sounds that one hears in films are synthesized electronically. They start with something organic. It may be the whining of their own dog, or it may be a wildlife recording from the Macaulay Library that then becomes a great sound effect in Raiders of the Lost Ark or a Harry Potter movie. And in both, I use those both as examples because both have used recordings, both did use recordings from the Macaulay Library.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And anyone with internet access can get on there and check it out, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You can play audio recordings and videos and view stills. Woof, 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 woof
So, Greg, you're the library's collections development curator. Could you tell us a little bit more about what that position entails, like what you do day-to-day? And
day-to-day is a fair bit of paperwork.
Sure.
You know how these things go. You start out working with audio recordings early on in one's career, and then you move into the administrative phase. So I work with a lot of the collaborators, especially some of the new collaborators, to encourage them to archive, work out archival agreements. Everything that comes into the Macaulay Library, all the media assets, come in with some type of agreement between the recordist and the library, which defines how the recordings are made available to the worldwide community. So there's a fair bit of discussion on that front, and I, of course, have to work with the archival team, who play the all-important role of then handling those resources that come into the collection and set an effective schedule for digitization if they need to be converted from an old analog format to digital, or just ingested digital resources that come in and how quickly they can be incorporated into the collection proper. Yeah. We're at a really exciting time right now in which it's now possible for individuals to upload recordings to the archive themselves.
Directly.
Okay. And there's a brief agreement that they're presented with when they submit those media files. And that's through a Macaulay Library and eBird, which is another major program of the Lab of Ornithology, interface. eBird allows people who are out bird watching to save the list of their observations on any event. They go out and spend a couple of hours in the morning looking at birds. They can create that list on the fly through a phone app and then come back to their computer, and if they use their phone or they used an over-the-shoulder dedicated recording system and made audio recordings, they can submit those recordings to accompany their checklist of bird observations.
Cool.
And that's, you can do that at your whim, either at the time or later that evening, whatever works for you.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And earlier you took me on a little tour of the lab here, and you showed me the room with all the archived audio. Could you talk a little bit about that and the process towards digitizing everything?
Sure. What you're referring to is our collection storage area, where we maintain all of the analog and digital tape based recordings, which is there's about 150,000 recordings in there for audio, and about 50,000 video recordings contained in the tape-based media. And it's an 800-square-foot room that's climate-controlled. It's kept at 20% humidity and 68 degrees Fahrenheit, which is pretty much ideal conditions for the long-term storage of tape, which doesn't like to go through temperature or humidity fluctuation. That can cause the tape to deform and problems arise. So up until about the year 2000, everything was stored on reel-to-reel tape. At least the audio material was stored on reel-to-reel tape, recorded at a speed of 15 inches per second. And that material could have been an analog cassette. It might have been reel-to-reel. And the reel-to-reel tapes were made at a variety of speeds. Everything was then optimized, the levels made as loud as possible without distortion, and recorded at 15 inches per second, so that when someone called up in the pre-digital days, we could go to one place in the shelf and find all of the recordings and know what speed they were at. So each reel that you were looking at in the collection contains only a single species, but there might be 20 reels for American robin and 10 reels for a downy woodpecker. All of those were copies of source recordings made in the analog domain.
Cool. And most of those source recordings were donated to the library?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Most were donated. The library, since its inception back in about 1930, has been a collaborative effort between scientists and volunteer recordists. And we talked about a few of those, a geneticist from Campbell's Soup, a banker who worked in the tropical Pacific, a rocket fuel scientist. We have a young man who worked in the Adirondacks, had no automobile, who would ride his bike through a snowstorm with his beautiful Swiss-made recorder strapped to the back of the bike through snow to record winter finches and sleep in a long overcoat on top of a mountaintop. So it really is an amazing diversity of people who have helped build the collection over the years.
Very cool. Yeah. So in perusing the archive, mostly yesterday, I was on it for a few hours, I noticed there was quite a variety in the audio recordings, just, well, A, in species, but then also in some of them were just straight-up recordings of the whatever the call was, but some of them included a description of what the recording was about to be of. For instance, I was listening to one of, I think it was an American black bear, and I think it was recorded up at Gore Mountain up in the Adirondacks. And whoever recorded it, I think it was a researcher, kind of described the scene before presenting it. So I guess I'm wondering, could you tell us a little bit about the audio recordings themselves and kind of like the variety that's there and like... there's a variety in quality, but then also just like in, I'm sure it kind of depends on who's doing it, whether they're research based or an enthusiast or hobbyist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you touched on a really good point. There is a tremendous range in fidelity of the recordings in the archive. And I think one of the fallacies is that recordings have to be of an archival quality, that they have to reach a certain fidelity standard. The standard really is, have you done as well as you can under the circumstances? Perfection doesn't come along every day. Perfect recording situations are really relatively rare. So our goal here at the Macaulay Library is working with volunteer collaborators and scientists to make the best recording they possibly can, given the conditions they're working under. And that could be wind, it could be rain, it could be... very typically, if you're working in a montane setting, there's running water nearby. And how can you best overcome that and get a decent signal that you could then analyze? And we really think in that way when it comes to acquisition and how we train people to use their directional microphones and to closely approach the animal without disturbing it to gather those sorts of recordings. So you sounds like it. You encountered a good cross section. Yeah. One of the key things, in addition to making the most fidelity wise as you possibly can achieve, is that you properly document the recording. You need species identification to the best of your ability, date, time, the physical location, a brief habitat description, the type of equipment you use, because that can affect the quality of the recording, how it might be analyzed. So those are all important facets. But then you also noticed that people were documenting behavior. And that's really what these recordings represent. Whether it's video or audio, you've captured a moment of behavior in these animals. And one of the really cool things about recording is the intimate setting you're in with this animal. Amazingly, an hour can pass by when you're making what amounts to a 10 or 15 minute recording. A lot of it's in your approach to the animal, how close you can get. But you're witnessing behavior in a way that a lot of people don't. They look at the animal, they identify it, and they move on. But when you record, you are watching a particular individual's behavior, and you're going to use that behavior to more closely approach it. So you see amazing things that a lot of people don't take in, and we really strongly encourage people to put a verbal note at the end of their recording about what they observed. And those data are as valuable as the audio recording itself, and they tremendously enrich the recording and its value for scientific research. You could record the song of an American robin, and it can be used by somebody studying American robin song. But if you record the observation of what the bird was doing, how it was behaving, interacting, say, with other robins, then it becomes, that same recording becomes valuable to an animal behavioralist, to someone that is creating a wildlife documentary, and they have a specific behavior they film, and they need the audio to match that. So it's an incredibly rich and compelling experience to be right there with these animals living their lives. Most of the time we just hear them, look at them, and we move on.
Right. Curious about it, a lot of the recordings in the archive look like they're from 40, 50 years ago. It seems like there's a lot from like the 60s and the 70s.
Right.
And you talked about how maybe the way that we go about recording the animals, like actually out in the field, like the approach and having to spend the time might not be all that different. But I'm curious about the evolution in technology over the last like 40 years and how that's kind of evolved from the earliest recordings in your archive to what comes in today.
The first technology used to record wildlife sounds was SoundSync film, right after it had been invented. And that was, of course, accessible only to a few people with a high level of financial backing to get a hold of that equipment. But in the 1950s, shortly after World War II, magnetic tape recorders became available. And that's when you really saw the volunteer recorders community starting to play a larger and larger role. People are captivated by birds, the songs they sing, their interesting behaviors, their colorful plumages. And so right from the very beginning, people began recording their amazing voices. And now, as we move into the digital realm, you can buy a digital recorder for a few $100s and a microphone for $400 or $500 that in the past might have cost you $2,000 to $5,000 to get a system of equivalent performance, and much smaller. It doesn't require 12 D-cell batteries to run anymore.
Right.
So those technological changes, the affordability and the more compact size, and the fact you can use your cell phone to make pretty decent recordings, is really leading to, an exponential surge in the number of people involved in this.
Right.
And that's where the self-serve capability, where you can upload your own recordings to the library, that's evolving to keep pace with this technological revolution which we're all undergoing right now.
Right. And so I'm assuming that you are getting just like a lot more submissions from all over?
We are. Over about a three-month period, we had over 5,000 audio recordings submitted through the upload capability. And that's what young people today expect. They've grown up in a time when you just go to the web through your cell phone and you have instant access to the information. And so the young scientist expects that immediacy in looking at data that's been gathered before, but also mechanisms for dealing with their own data. They don't expect to wait years to archive their material. They expect to be able to put it into a system very efficiently. And so that's what we're creating here at the Macaulay Library, a system that's not only embodies our archival principles of the past, of good quality resolution of the files and doing the utmost to disseminate the data that's been collected, but the immediacy that young researchers expect and need to carry out their research today. So,
right.
Exciting times.
Yeah. So the Macaulay Library is affiliated with it's housed within the Lab of Ornithology here on Cornell's campus. But you have, I mentioned the American black bear, and I was listening to all sorts of recordings yesterday, like Galapagos tortoise, spotted hyena. We were talking about frogs earlier. Do you place an emphasis on recordings of birds and bird calls, or is it really kind of whatever users want to submit? Like, is there an emphasis or something that you?
Our history is with the recordings of birds as the Lab of Ornithology. It's an institution dedicated to the study of birds.
Right.
And so we, over the years, interacted with many ornithologists and bird watchers. Increasingly, no one walks away from a great sound. You've got portable recording equipment. Ornithologist or herpetologist alike, they're going to record what they encounter in the field. And we find that cross-fertilization in terms of development of the archive, where you have people from different disciplines with different research objectives collecting material of different taxa other than what they work on. So that emphasis is not what it once was on birds. And birds were an obvious thing to go after. They're very vocal. And if you think about the animals you've heard make sound, birds are going to be right up at the top of the list. And then it's going to be things like frogs, insects. And those are growing bodies of material here. And within the next year or two, we're going to allow, or we're creating the taxonomic backbone, if you will, that will allow the upload of those recordings on a self-serve basis by contributors. Right now, it's really bird material and some environmental sound recordings that people can upload that are supported through the taxonomy or the naming structure that's available online.
Gotcha.
But it's going to become much more capable.
Gotcha. I wish we had, 2 hours to talk. I have so many more questions. But for the sake of time, I have, I guess, one more question for you. Do you have a favorite recording in the archive, or that you just like particularly enjoy?
I have many, Will, but if forced to choose, I will put forth the musician wren, which is a really extraordinary little brown wren that inhabits the Amazon, spends its life flipping over leaves looking for insects, but it has a remarkable song. Absolutely remarkable that I'm sure your listeners are going to enjoy hearing.
Fantastic. Well, Greg, thanks a lot for joining us. Really appreciate your time and you sharing all your knowledge and your enthusiasm for the archive and sounds.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.